May it please the court. In assessing the sufficiency of the evidence with respect to the one count that Mr. Stuckey was convicted of, I think it's important to know that the evidence established that Richard Epps, the other person who was on the phone conversation, that is the basis of the telephone count conviction, and my client, had a competitive relationship. Mr. Epps himself admitted that he was trying to take over the drug business at St. Stephen's and establish a foothold there after he had been kicked out of the 340 Western building across the street, and that he was lying to Mr. Stuckey frequently in his phone conversations, was concealing information from him about his drug dealing and his drug sources. And their relationship was built on distrust rather than the sort of thing that conspirators might have, which is an understanding and an agreement. And I think that when you consider his testimony, along with all the testimony that was before the jury, it explains why I think the jury acquitted my client of all the counts, including the conspiracy account, with the sole exception of this single telephone count. Now, I think with that backdrop, it's easy to see that nothing that happened in this telephone conversation in any way made Mr. Epps' drug business easier. And that is the relevant legal standard that this court has announced several times. What about this conversation on November 20th, 2001, made it easier for a drug conspiracy to exist or to go on? And the evidence is clear that Mr. Epps had his own source of supply, in fact concealed that information from all of the people that he dealt with, that he was trying to move in and take over the territory, that he wanted to sell much larger quantities, even out of this 1 kilogram of cocaine that he said that he obtained. He wasn't looking to sell quantities that Mr. Stuckey was interested in buying. He wanted to sell, and right in the face of the conversation, he said he's looking to sell quarters and 9 ounces of cocaine. And it's clear that, as Mr. Epps himself admitted as a government witness, that he had never sold drugs to LaShawn Stuckey. And during the life of what was the charged conspiracy that, even according to the government, had lasted 5 weeks, that he hadn't sold him heroin, he hadn't sold him cocaine, and he hadn't sold him crack cocaine, which the conspiracy alleged that my client was allegedly involved in such an agreement with him and others. He admitted that he was lying in the conversation, that he didn't have a kilogram of cocaine in his possession. He admitted lying when he said that it was powder cocaine instead of crack cocaine, because he didn't have any cocaine at all. He admitted lying when he said that it was of good quality. And he also acknowledged that Mr. Stuckey was just one of many people that he had tried to contact, that as soon as he got off the phone with Mr. Stuckey, he contacted numerous other people. Now, if he's to be believed, the next day he got a kilogram of cocaine. But he also acknowledged that he never sold any of that cocaine to Mr. Stuckey, not one speck of it. In fact, he didn't even go to Mr. Stuckey to cook it. In fact, he went to some other individual, Demetrius West, and he cooked the cocaine. And when he found the cocaine unsatisfactory, he returned it to his supplier, Tommy Parra. And so the question remains, what effect, if any, did the conversation on November 20th have on any of the drug business that Richard Epps was involved in? He didn't lower his price. He didn't get a greater supply. He didn't use Mr. Stuckey to help coordinate the delivery of the drugs or package the drugs or cook the drugs or weigh the drugs. He didn't. That conversation led to nothing. I submit, and as I argue in my brief, that if Mr. Stuckey had said in that conversation, "Richard Epps, why don't you drop dead?" that there would have been no more of an effect on his drug conspiracy than anything he did say in the conversation. And such facilitation has to mean something. It has to mean that you were able to meet up with somebody, or you were able to get a larger quantity or a cheaper price, or or you were able to do something. And in this case, the government points to no evidence which suggests that somehow the single conversation made easier Mr. Epps' purchase, sale, distribution, packaging, or agreement to sell drugs. Now, with respect to the second argument that we advance in our brief, we recognize that this court has yet to accept or embrace the idea that quantity and types of drugs are elements of the offense of an 846 conspiracy. Other circuits are heading that way, and I think ultimately that will be the rule. But whatever one thinks about whether that ought to be the rule or should be the rule, in this case, the government did specifically allege three separate types of drugs and specifically enumerated what the scope of the conspiracy was. And as we argue in our brief, when the government makes such an allegation and specifically commits itself to that type of conspiracy, then it has to prove it. Whether or not it could, as a general matter, prove something else or allege something else. They alleged a specific conspiracy and, in fact, got the benefit of introducing, loads of evidence that only had to do with heroin or only had to do with crack cocaine. Numerous conversations with Albert Spann and others, not involving my client at all, that would not have otherwise been admissible but for the conspiracy that they wholeheartedly embraced and charged. But then when it came to the time to instruct the jury, they wanted the jury to be told that they did not have to prove the conspiracy they charged. All they had to prove was some other conspiracy, what they characterized as a smaller conspiracy, and what I characterized as a completely different agreement. It's obviously, we all know that it is black-letter law that a conspiracy is merely an agreement, and it is the agreement that forms the crime, and it is the agreement that is the core of the offense. And here they charged a very specific agreement with very specific objectives. When they found their evidence wanting, and when the jury specifically asked a question, do we have to find all of the drugs, all the types of drugs that are enumerated, they then opted for the no answer. And our view is that when they opted for the no answer and when the judge gave the no answer over our objection, that the indictment was constructively amended and that this was a different conspiracy than they had alleged, a different conspiracy than they had argued for when they offered evidence of heroin and crack cocaine. And quite frankly, it was a different conspiracy than what they had said all along was what their conspiracy was. I submit that constitutes a constructive amendment, and if the court finds that there is sufficient evidence on this 843B count, then in the alternative, we are requesting a new trial. I see
okay.
My time is out.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chauvin. Mr. Lausch?
May it please the court, John Lausch for the United States. Your Honors, we ask you to affirm the conviction and the judgment of the court below, the conviction of Mr. Stuckey, and in particular getting directly to the sufficiency of the evidence on the phone count and the facilitation. The evidence here clearly demonstrated that the phone conversation was designed to facilitate the conspiracy. Mr. Chauvin did not even go through the telephone conversation. What the telephone conversation, what a clear reading of it shows is that Mr. Epps indicated that he wanted to sell a kilo of cocaine. He needed to sell it quickly in order to get an ongoing relationship with the supplier. Mr. Stuckey offered to buy some of that cocaine. They talked about a price. They talked about a quality. And Mr. Stuckey offered to find additional buyers. Now, if that isn't facilitating a drug conspiracy, I don't know what is. It'd be like you have an individual who's looking to buy a car talking with a car dealer. And during their conversation, they talk about the type of car, they talk about a price for the car, they talk about the quality of the car. But simply because the fact that the car isn't on the car lot, there could have been no facilitation. And that's the argument that, that counsel's making by saying that this is an imaginary kilo. The evidence actually demonstrates that it wasn't. Several conversations that we describe in our brief, a lot of evidence described in our brief that talked about this was, in fact, a real kilo of cocaine. This was a kilo that Mr. Epps expected to get. He did receive. And once he received that, he actually did take it to the place where Mr. Stuckey was, which I guess kind of gets back to another.
What's your explanation for the acquittal on all these counts?
My explanation for the acquittal on the conspiracy count, I think it could easily be judged that they felt sorry for the defendant.
He testified in sir rebuttal or something.
He did. He testified in sir rebuttal.
Was he a likable guy or something?
Mr. Stuckey,
Judge. He was a nice little hustle guy or something.
Mr. Stuckey's in the courtroom, Your Honor. He's in the back of the courtroom. He's a very young-looking individual. He's in the back. He's wearing a... the braids and the fur coat.
I'm glad because my nephew is sitting in the back in a blue shirt. So
okay.
I'm glad we got the right guy.
And I point that out, given your specific question, Judge, I mean, who knows why a jury decides to do what they do? I mean, just as Mr. Shobat says, they bought his argument on buyer-seller. You know, I can make the same argument that, you know, I think that they nullified when they saw Mr. Stuckey and they decided to cut him a break. And they think that, and they thought that they would. Find what they thought was a lesser count. Both of those are irrelevant to what we're dealing with here. It's whether or not the evidence is sufficient, Judge. Mm-hmm. And it's our position that the evidence is clearly sufficient. And on the facilitation, as I indicated, I think what's clear is that this conversation, especially when taken in context with the other conversations on that day and the next day, and the evidence on those 2 days shows that this was designed to further the drug conspiracy. On the final issue regarding the type and the quantity of the drugs and the instructions to the jury, we've addressed that thoroughly several times below and in our brief. And unless any of you have any questions about that, I'd conclude my argument.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Welch.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Shobat, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Very briefly, if I may.
Your Honors, Mr. Epps is not present in court today. And if you had seen him, I think you would understand why the jury found my client not guilty of all of the counts. He was a horrible, horrible witness and was not a truth teller. And I think the jury saw that. And obviously, with respect to why they found him guilty of this count, I think the erroneous instruction played a part of it. Clearly, they were troubled by it. They weren't troubled by any of the other telephone counts. And I think probably the specificity of the language in this count is what maybe bowled them over and caused them to find him guilty of this count. But the specificity notwithstanding, we could talk about buying a truck if we like. That doesn't make the sale of the truck easier or doesn't facilitate the sale of the truck when there really isn't a truck and it never happens. And the dealer is not interested really in selling the truck to this individual. Certainly, he wants to sell the whole truck to one person, and it's clear from that conversation that Mr. Stuckey was not interested in that truck.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Shabbat and Mr. Lausch. And you were appointed, were you not?
I was.
So we thank you for your vigorous efforts.
You're welcome.
Last case for argument is United States versus O'Neill. Mr. McGowan.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. And I represent the appellant, Mr. James O'Neill, in this case. We've raised three issues. I intend to discuss the argument that the district court impermissibly participated in the plea negotiations unless this